Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast, helping engineers, producers, and artists create professional recordings and mixes, even from home. I'm your host, Mike Indovina. Let's get started. Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast. My name is Mike Indovina, and thank you for hanging out with me today. Today, my guest is Phil Eck, and if you're not familiar with Phil, Phil is a producer, engineer, and mixer based out of Seattle, Washington, and he's worked with a ton of great artists, including Built the Spill, Fleet Foxes, Band of Horses, Modest Mouse, The Shins, and so many more. And in this interview, we cover a lot of ground. We cover everything from Phil working in Seattle during the early 90s and getting to work with Jack Endino and being in the heart of the grunge boom and what that was all like. And then we also talk about Phil's work on Built to Spill's There's Nothing Wrong with Love, which is a classic indie record. And then we dive into more of Phil's process when it comes to establishing the vibe of an album and what kind of techniques go into making sure that you're capturing the right performances. And we get into everything from creating the right scratch tracks so that your artists feed off of those. We talk about editing and how that relates to performance and how that relates to feel. We talk about things like using reverb and when to use it, when not to use it during the recording process, and then how to shape it during the mixing stage so that you can have it really big and loud in a mix and create that vibe of a record, but without it being too muddy or getting in the way of other instruments. And Phil shares some great tips for how he likes to do that as well. This is a really awesome interview. I think you're going to learn a lot from it. So with that said, let's just jump right into it. Phil Eck, thank you so much for being on the Master Your Mix podcast. How's it going, man?
Very good. Thank you for having me.
Of course. For people who might not be familiar with you and your background, how you got started in this industry, what you're working on these days, can you give us that kind of backstory?
You know, I've been making records in Seattle, which is where I'm based, and since around 1990, 1991, after high school. I grew up in a town called Bremerton, which is a ferry ride away from Seattle. I moved here right out of high school and went to the Art Institute of Seattle for recording, just for the most reasons, just to get out of Bremerton and, you know, try something new. And I was always interested in records and interested in the production of sounds, especially since Sub Pop and things of that nature, early grunge records were really, really exciting and happening. It was a big, big moment in the music business in Seattle. So I moved here to go to the Art Institute, and wasn't the greatest experience, but due to going there, I met some really great teachers and ultimately connected me with a studio called Word of Mouth Studios. This producer engineer who owned it, Rich Hinklin, really took me under his wing. And that's also how I met Jack Endino, who was still associated with that studio, because that studio before Word of Mouth was called Reciprocal Recording. And that's where, you know, Nirvana did Bleach and Soundgarden and Mudhoney and those things. So I ended up assisting those guys on a lot of records. And I kind of worked with Jack on a lot of cool things and a lot of work with Rich on a lot of cool things. And was basically the in-house producer of that studio where, you know, when grunge really took off in, let's say, 92, and Jack got really busy and he was now flying to, you know, New York or LA or England or whatever, I kind of picked up the slack of just the guys who came through the door and did, you know, endless amounts of demos and, you know, 2 days with 15 songs, cassette releases to get shows and that kind of stuff. And you really learn your chops quickly when you have to do things like that, and especially on tape. So that's how I started, and met a guy named Chris Tacchino, owned a label called Up Records, which is basically sort of a subsidiary of Sub Pop Records. And that's how I ended up doing Built Spill Record and many other records for his label. And it really just went from there. Built Spill, Nothing Wrong But Love was probably the biggest change in my career, my ability to continue to do this and not just be a young kid hitting record for people and making demos, making albums and moving forward. So that's how I moved on. And I did that for years and years and was able to, you know, work with local artists that became quite successful, like Band of Horses or Fleet Foxes and Modest Mouse and other things like The Shins, as well as I used to tour those bands. I used to make records with artists and tour with them after I made it as their live sound guy. Just, you know, it was fun and it was easy and not easy, but it was fun work to go out and make the records sound like, you know, or the show sound like the records that we just made. So yeah, that's how I did it. Kept going. And I guess it's here that I am today. I've done, you know, a bunch of Fleet Foxes record, Father John Misty records. I just did a, you know, record from this artist, Tyler Ramsey, who used to be in Band of Horses, you know, bands like The Walkmen and things of that nature. But yeah, almost 34 years later, still doing it, still making records all the time, mixing people's records all the time. You know, I do producing and engineering of my own albums and, yeah, mix all my own records. And yeah, it's been a fun journey and an honor to be able to have, just the success enough to allow me the freedom to do it and I guess talk to people like you about it.
Love that, man. Was the goal always to get into the studio and be an engineer, or were you
No, I was in bands as a guitar player and, you know, played music around high school and things of that nature. And it really, where I grew up was a fairly, you know, is a military naval town, and my family was not in the military. So that wasn't really a place I wanted to stay. And as I kind of got more, I don't know, more disassociated with where I was living and no plans of what I wanted to do, I didn't want to go to college. Felt like if I continued on this path of just doing, you know, college prerequisites in high school and going to college, I just felt like, I don't know, sort of a trap, I guess. I just felt like my entire life I've been in school. I don't want to continue to be in school. So it was really, the Art Institute was just and being infatuated with local artists that really excited me. Just felt like, well, if people can make records in Seattle and I like recording people in four tracks and I like being in bands and I like being around music, I'll try that. And it really just went like a, you know, why not kind of direction. And then I ended up really liking it and felt I was pretty good at it, I guess, not to toot my own horn, but I didn't find the technical aspect of engineering, which I knew very little about, just, you know, not much about, I guess, going into it. I didn't find it that difficult. And so it came to me fairly naturally just to get sounds and understand how flow of signal worked and things when you really had to know that with running a board and running tape machines. And I just, I think there's also some really, really cool people that teachers at the Art Institute, this guy Tom Dyer being most important to me, that just liked me and was really cool and let me work with him on sessions of his own and after hours at that school and on weekends. And I engineered things for them and he was cool and punk rock and his favorite artist was Captain Beefheart and that was rad to me. And so those people that were really just like, you're good at this, you should try, continue to do this. And it was definitely Tom that reached out to Jack and Dino and that was a big, big, big deal to me. And Jack was extremely nice and extremely gracious and his time was very cool and open to me. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot of young people when I was very young, 19, 20 years old. There's a lot of cool mentors that just had no reason to help me, but did.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I've noticed about just even running this podcast is like this industry, there's so many people that seem like untouchable in it, but yet like everyone's just friendly, yeah. You know? And as long as you're a cool person, then, you know, people are willing to chat and help you out and all that kind of stuff. It's very cool.
Yeah. I mean, you don't really need to know anything as long as you're not an asshole. And as long as you can be a fly on the wall and learn and, you know, everybody wants somebody in the studio to help run some of my cables and, you know, headphone lines and stuff that just, you know, takes up time. It's super fun. You know, as long as you're excited and you know how to just be respectful of everybody else's work and time, then you'll be brought in, you know, with open arms. So that's what it was like, especially in Seattle at that time. It was a small city. It's a small city now, but it was really small then. Didn't seem to me at the time. I thought like this is the big city and wow, you know, but looking back, everybody knows everybody. They were really, really helpful in that regard.
For sure. Well, yeah, I mean, you can't get it. You can't go into this industry acting like a know-it-all, you know, even if you do feel like you know quite a bit of stuff. It's when you want to work with someone else, you're now in their environment. They've got their way of doing things. So, like, you've got to learn to adapt to their processes, and that's how you advance. I think that's some good stuff to talk about. You talked about, you know, moving to Seattle and being there in the 90s, which was obviously, like, a massive time for, like, the grunge world and all that. How would you say that being in that environment impacted like your early days of being in the studio, like as far as, you know, learning how to record artists and, you know, the way that things were being recorded back then, like, do you feel like that's impacted your career to this day?
I mean, back in those days, you know, these things were done, and if you had a week to record, that was luxury. Most people, these records were made in days, 4, 5, 6 days. Records I was doing, you know, 3 days. So you really had to go quickly. And when working with Jack, one thing that is interesting with him specifically is he would do a lot of EQing, a lot. And his reasoning was these guys would show up with these sludgy, murky tone, you know, big muffs and sludgy tone guitars, down-tuned D guitars. And his only way to do it was to go quickly, was to EQ everything kind of around it, make a sandwich of things. Like the kick drum had this low and high, just really visually place things in a certain way. And although that wasn't necessarily something I wanted to always do, it really taught me, oh, you have to adapt quickly and understand quickly what a sound sounds like, not think about it as much, and just trust your gut that this will all piece together. And Jack was really good at that. And I learned a lot watching him put the puzzle together of all the oral aspects of the record or sounds of the song and the record. So in that, I learned that you should just go quickly. And yeah. Don't think too much about changing the mic as much as trying to make it work as quickly as possible. You know, for better or worse, but you learn a lot about sound quickly that way.
Yeah. Do you feel like that's still kind of your approach to this day, where like maybe now you have more time to work on records, but do you still feel like you need to be like super quick with it and not spend as much time on mic positioning and that kind of thing? Or
Probably less so. I think I do more. I think I would be more mic changing and amp manipulation than I did then. But sometimes I just throw it up and go, oh, sounds cool, go. And or I know I can make it sound better down the line or something like that. But usually, I guess now because I do have more time, it's a little bit of both, where you trust yourself maybe more, and maybe you have the time to just go out there and move the mic a bit or change a 57 to a 414 or something like that.
Yeah. I'm assuming too that with your experience, you've also kind of learned like, okay, like, yeah, I could move the mic a little more to the center of the cone and that's going to give me a brighter sound, or I could just boost this frequency. Like, you kind of know the alternative ways to get the same result, right?
Yeah. And also just maybe how quote unquote important that individual track is. If it's like a main guitar, maybe I would go and spend more time adjusting the microphone, so it sounds less manipulated possibly, or it give me more of a full range sound right off from the source. And maybe it's the 12th guitar line. I might just go, oh, I'll just EQ it from here. And it's maybe not less important, but we've established the sonic spectrum, which I do like to start with a more natural sound from the beginning. Gives me more of a chance to mess with it later.
For sure. And I think that that's a really good point too, of like that idea of prioritizing instruments, because you can't just make every instrument the priority when you're recording and get the most clean, pristine sound, because then you're working so much harder in the mix to try to make it work. So, it makes sense to kind of have that idea of like, this is the more important one. We're going to spend the time on this. Everything else can be a little darker or murky or whatever. Like,
I guess people do sell and listen to stems, you know, in the stereo spectrum or even the Atmos spectrum. You're not hearing it that way. You're not hearing it individually. You're hearing it as a full song. So it doesn't matter what it sounds like individually. It matters what it sounds like in the full song, for little parts. But, you know, main spectrum kicks and snares and bass guitar and, let's say, rhythm guitar and maybe your piano or keyboards or whatever is supplying the majority of the chordal information, I like to make sure that those are as big and pristine and as natural to start with as possible. And if I want to mess with them or fuck them up or distort them or add a bunch of effects or whatever, I can do that, but always knowing that if I take that stuff off, it still sounds great. So that's how I start that stuff. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you're just thinking of the big picture the whole time. Yeah, makes sense
from the get-go.
Yeah. You talked about earlier how working with Band of Horses, or sorry, Built to Spill was kind of like your big turning point in your career, working on the There's Nothing Wrong with Love record. And I saw like Spin Magazine had quoted it or said it was like one of the top indie records of all time, which is super cool. Yeah. I'm curious to get your thoughts, like looking back at that record now, like why do you think it was such a turning point in your career? And what do you think it is about that record that's contributed to its long legacy?
As far as this long legacy, it's just because there's great songs and it has emotional connection, and that's always my opinion, what creates a legacy record or maybe a legacy artist. It's just, he's just a really smart songwriter and a genius musician and lyricist. And, as far as like how it changed my, you know, my career as it were, it was the first time I ever recorded a record where I, you know, Doug came in. It was Doug and Brett Nelson, the bass player, and this guy, Andy Capps, who unfortunately has passed away, but was the drummer at the time. And they set up in the same little corners that I always put everybody. It's this place called John and Stu's, which was the studio after Word of Mouth, the same studio, but different owners. And I'm making up his Fender Twin, and he goes, oh, you know, don't really worry about my guitar. I'm not going to keep any of that. And then I was like, oh, weird. Like I was so used to recording live and then you maybe double a guitar and add a solo and vocals and you're kind of done. And, you know, he goes, oh yeah, don't worry about that. I'm going to have all my guitars completely scratch. I'm just going to play the basic parts for those guys to go through the songs. And then I'm going to overdub everything. And that was mind blowing to me. I was like, oh, cool. Okay. And so we did the drums and bass really quickly. And it was just me and him adding tons of layers. And I think we spent 2 weeks, maybe more, probably more, at least recording that record and that or around that. And that was just unbelievable luxury to me. I'd never seen anything like that before. But Chris Tacchino, who ran Up Records, you know, knew that this was going to be a big deal and knew that this was going to be a successful thing. And he knew Doug's songs more than I did. And he knew Doug prior to Built to Spill and his band Tree People. And, you know, he already made his first album, Ultimate Alternative Waivers, which I thought was genius. So it just was an exciting time. And we really just hit it off. You know, we talked about records we like, and I was like, oh, I really love that Pixies song. He's, oh, you love the Pixies? I love the Pixies. Like, let's try to do that one guitar thing on that whatever song. And we really became close friends. And yeah, ended up making 6 albums with that guy after that. And that record was hugely successful. And he got signed to Warner Brothers from that. It changed a lot of things for both of us. It opened the doors of the music business to us. Before that, I think we were just guys who made records and played music and toured them. And I don't know if we, either one of us really thought we were part of the music business. We were just dudes doing it. So that's the biggest thing, that record was a big tipping point.
I love that. Do you feel like, you know, with the success of that record, I'm assuming that afterwards, you know, that hopefully I would have assumed that after that record came out and became what it was, that like that was probably bringing in a lot of work for you. But do you feel like your process changed after that record, like having the luxury of that time and learning, like, you know, you can overdub everything. Do you feel like you, like after that, you started doing that same sort of thing with all the records that followed?
100%. I mean, that's just the first time I did it that way. And I kind of still do it that way. I like to record everybody, if it's a band, not necessarily like a songwriter or whatever, but if it's a band that knows their songs well, and maybe, you know, we've done some pre-production together. I really do like the artists to all play together, mostly because I like, if the artist wants to, I don't mind doing drums first and with nobody playing and playing to a click, I don't mind that. But I like everybody playing together because it's nice to hear the song as a whole the entire time, to know if a drummer needs to play harder or softer or attack the chorus more or whatever we want the song to ultimately push on based on hearing the full scope of the song as much as possible. But I'm not usually focusing on keeping the other tracks much. Sometimes I'll keep bass because it's locked in with the drums, or I'll keep parts of the bass tracks or whatever, but guitars and keyboards and certainly vocals and those type of things, I'm almost never keeping. They're just guides for the process, and then we overdub them mostly for performance and just literally sonic reasons, changing amp sounds and all that kind of stuff. You spend every moment changing your sound of your amp for every song, the drummer is getting pretty bored. so that is how I still do records. I still, and I, yeah, I from it was a no, don't look back from that record on.
Sure. Well, that's a really cool approach because, like, yeah, you hear so many stories of people that'll be like, yeah, let's just lay down a scratch guitar and, like, you know, they kind of half-ass a take on guitar and then the drummer plays along to that. But then you're right, like, all of that feel just goes out the window because, like, they're playing to this half-ass recorded take that, you know. Yeah. So
I like every, I mean, we could do, like, one or two good takes of a guitar that feel like, you know, it's a good approach. And we all agree by listening back at, yes, this is how the song is going to ultimately energy-wise go. So they don't have to keep performing it over and over again. We can keep using the same guitar track over and over again. But as long as it feels like what we're listening to is accurate enough to build a song off of energy-wise and emotion-wise, that's all I care about. And we'll overdub all the other sounds. And knowing that we have a great bed to lay all that onto is how I approach the basic tracking process.
That makes sense. So then just to take a step back, I guess, like when you start working on a record and you're producing it or engineering it, like what are some of your first steps that you would normally take, you know, approaching a new artist and getting started with like getting the atmosphere and the vibe of a record kind of solidified?
Well, I guess it would just be pre-production stuff. I guess it would just be, and these days pre-production stuff is less in the room together with more just over email and Zooms and stuff like that, just cost reasons. And I work with very few local artists these days. Most of the records I work on are across the country, LA, New York, you know, England, you know, Canada, you know, very few Seattle artists. Mostly there's a lot less artists in Seattle. Seattle has become a quite expensive city where back in the 90s it was really cheap. So there were just more artists around that had the ability to make records. But I guess we're just making sure that we have the right songs first. That's all that matters, is that you have the great songs to make a record with. So we work on that. Any arrangement ideas that I or they have, we work on that together. Tempos, try to get that to feel the right tempo, which usually we adjust quite a bit more in the initial recording stages. But just knowing that they have, as much as possible, we're all on the same page, and that they have their chops as much as possible ready to go, that whoever's going to be playing whatever can do it. That's probably the hardest part about modern recording, is you get a lot of demos from artists who have home studios who can spend as much time as they want editing, chopping up any way they want. And it seems like it's a cool song. It seems like, you know, you don't want to be insulting. Can you actually play this, guys? Because we're not using your tracks again. You don't want to bother them and make them feel like they're, you know, disrespectful. But sometimes you get in the studio with them and they're a band, not a band. You know, they can write great songs, but maybe the singer literally played everything, kind of, and edited it all together, and it sounds good enough. And you get in the room with them, and maybe they're not as versed as they think they are in their instruments or whatever. So, trying to eliminate any setbacks is probably the biggest part about modern records for me. Is being as open and communicative in the process to say, we have to be able to perform this, and I need you to perform this to a great level so that we can get great takes, so we can get the right emotion, so we can supply these to people well above your demo. We have to outdo it, you know, a million times over. So that's the biggest part about modern records for me right now.
For sure. So then, like, what role does editing play for you? Like, obviously, if you're working with a lot of artists that, like, maybe can't play their parts right away, some people would, there's like two schools of thought, right? There's like some people would be like, okay, practice the shit out of this until you learn it and you're perfect at it. And then there's the other people who are like, yeah, I can fix this later. Like, we'll take what we can get, you know?
I think it's a bit of both. You know, it's, you know, it's, there's nothing wrong with not being a virtuoso. You know, you have, it's mostly like, did you write a great song? And can you perform this to a level that at least we can get it edited and not have it. I think laboring over editing to make it sound natural sucks. I think, you know, editing to take better parts of cool performances, that could be 20 performances, but they all have their own cool thing about it, is way I like to look at it. I don't need you to be perfect in your performance, and I'm not looking for you to do this in one, two takes and have it be amazing. You can, we'll do as many takes as it really needs to be cool, but I don't want to fix your performances to just make it seem like you played it correctly. I want to pick the cool parts of your performance. So editing is as much as anybody else does, but not so much to fix it, but to make it cool.
Yeah, just capturing like those best, the best parts, and like more like comping.
Yeah, it's exactly like comping. It's the same way we used to do it on tape. Just lots of punching. You know, none of those old tape records were made or continuous performances, a zillion punches on them. So it's the same idea as comping, I suppose, but you're having to play a lot more.
Yeah, so you're not necessarily like beat detectiving and elastic autoing every like hit and all that kind of stuff. Yeah,
I'll do that. If needed, or if it's time wise, it's like that tambourine's literally it's bang bang bang. It's on the snare drum. It's fine. We'll be detective and put it in its place. And it doesn't need to be this great performance. It's just a sonic element I want to hear. It doesn't matter if it's not. There's no emotion to it. It just sounds cool. Yeah. So that stuff I do all the time. And you know, if it's all comp background vocals to one chorus to the same to the next chorus, you know, using the same performances multiple times. Again, if it's what sounds coolest. I'm no purist. It doesn't need to be this pure performance every time, but I do want those performances to be as natural as possible, at least to start with.
Fair, for sure. That's very cool. Well, like one thing that I was really curious to know about when it comes to your records is like listening to a lot of the records that you've done, such as like the new, is it Simmel? I can never remember how to say that.
It's a Welsh word. It means simple.
Okay, perfect. So yeah, like listening to that Simmel record or Band of Horses or Father John Misty, like those records there, to me, like one of the really cool things about those records is like just the vibe of those records and the ambience of those records. Like to me, I think that's like it's a big part of the record, you know, it's what really establishes the aesthetic of those artists. And so I'm curious to know, like when it comes to establishing that vibe, is that often something that most of these artists just kind of seem to come to you with, or is it something that like you guys are really being conscious of during the process and thinking like, okay, like the songs are good, the parts are cool, but like we can make them bigger and give more of this cool feel to it. Like,
yeah, that's my perspective is the songs are great and I know I can make it bigger. I think the bands, you know, I think maybe with Band of Horses, that was just a lot of it was just, you got to trust me, man. Like this is his first album, especially Everything All the Time was Ben's first album at the Band of Horses. First time being a singer, guitar player, and a songwriter, you know, the front man of a band. And so he didn't have the perspective that this is going to be okay. In fact, it was really hard for him and a lot of work, but I just kept saying, it's going to be great. You have to listen to me. We're going to make the guitars big. Your vocals are going to be soaring and it's going to be a lot of performance work for you. And it was hard for him, but that's going to matter. So that was my opinion of that record and that band from the beginning. And then there's maybe other artists that came to me after that because they liked that record. Yeah, I mean, as a record producer, you have these little funny dips and valleys in your career, not so much how much you're working, but you have these little, or for me, I've had these little plateaus, or not plateaus, but peaks of what people gravitate towards. Like, oh, I love Built to Spill. So I want other bands that sound like or are inspired by Built to Spill want to work with me because I did a Built to Spill record, or they want to work with me because I did Fleet Foxes record, they want to work with me because I did a Shins record, or they want to work with me Band of Horses or similar, whatever down the line. They go, wow, these are really cool records. So you get art like-minded artists based on, you know, what they're liking of any given record I've done. So those are the reasons that, you know, I think that there's similarities because there's bands that are fans of those different records.
That makes sense. So then when it comes to those kind of records where, you know, you have like the bigger reverbs and like the big drums and all that kind of stuff, how much of that do you take care of during the tracking process versus adding it later in post?
Well, reverb, none. Yeah, reverb is all added in post. It's all in mixing.
Okay.
I've had some pretty... interesting emails, like when the first Flea Foxes album came out, like I had some engineer producer people ask me if I recorded Robin in a grain silo. I'm like, no, that's a plate reverb, man. know, like he's in a room just like any other studio, just singing into the 67 and had a bunch of reverb. So yeah, but drum sounds, I especially drum sounds, I like to record in larger rooms. I definitely like to record room sounds, definitely, but I also make sure that the drums close are great sounding and tight and clear. And then if I take off the room sounds, again, those tight sounds are great and usable. And I try to make an all around usability template for drums and having maybe some gobos around the drums, maybe even the front that have the drums initially close sound tight and clean and punchy and fat or whatever. And then also have the rooms in different, I have like a close mics and a close mid to close room mics, a further away mic sometimes, and speakers down the hallway to be able to turn on anytime I want without having to reamp or necessarily use reverbs or things like that. But I can just literally pop these mics on to make the chorus sound like it opens up, and literally nothing changed in the performance other than room mics got turned on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I guess that's one of the benefits of working in a big room is that you can have those mics set up as those options. Whereas if you're in a basement or something like that, I mean, you're probably not going to get the biggest sound to begin with, but you know, you're very limited in what you can do, right?
Yeah. And you know, this, you know, yeah, I again, I have the luxury of doing this for so long where I do get a track in bigger rooms. And so that is my way of going about it. But I suppose if I wasn't in a home studio, yeah, it would be, back in the day, certainly we used to record in quite small spaces, like the, you know, where we did Built Spill and the things I did with Jack. That was a tiny little studio. It's called Hall of Justice now. It's owned by Chris Waller from Death Cab for Cutie, but it's small, but it's usable. But if you wanted a room sound, you had to like do tricks of compression or, you know, or light distortions or reverbs and things like that, that I do maybe less of in a, I need this to sound bigger way, and more in a treatment. Like, this is a fun, exciting sound, but I don't need to rely on that sound to make it feel roomy. Where back in the day, I probably would have done those tricks too, because I need it to feel roomy, and or I really want it to feel roomy, and this is the only way I can do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm assuming too, that like when you are working in these bigger rooms and you have the multi mic or room mic setup, like, yeah, they're not necessarily always on. Like, you might just mute some of them for certain tracks and that kind of thing, right?
Oh yeah. Mute them all the time or turn them way down. They're just kind of lightly in the mix, and then I pop them up louder and versus second verse or second chorus or the bridge, just to give a different feel to that part of the song. It's a cool way to produce different emotional feelings. Like, especially if like the bridge goes halftime or something like that, and there's a lot more space in the drums than there was in the chorus or the verse, and the guitars become more affected, more delays or reverbs happen because that part of the song has a more ethereal aspect. Just turning on the room mics and kind of creates that more of a three-dimensionality to the song. And you didn't have to do a whole lot of tricks to make it happen. You just literally turn those mics up or on. So that's how I start the approach for sure.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a really cool approach. And yeah, it's like, I feel like a lot of people these days, just because they can record lots of tracks in digital, like they also feel like they need to use it all, right? And so,
that is true. Yeah. That is very true.
So yeah,
it's definitely, you do not need to do everything all at once.
Yeah, but I mean, hey, it's like when you're doing drums or something like that, that's like really time consuming to get set up. It's like, set it up, get all your options, and then you can mess with them later. And maybe have a couple mics that just kind of sound like garbage, but like that could be cool in one spot.
Absolutely. Drums being the most kind of time consuming, stressful, but most thoughtful part of the process. We really have to focus on every little noise and rattle and make sure clicks aren't bleeding in headphones and all those things, to make sure you're not having problems 20 days from now or whatever it is. You're not having to fight getting rid of something, that you're really focusing, man, put up as many mics as you possibly can, and they're easy to get rid of if you don't use them or deactivate them or whatever, if you need the voicing is or whatever your scenario is with your Pro Tools rig, but might as well have them.
Yeah, for sure. What you also mentioned earlier about how, like, when you would record an artist that has like a lot of roominess in their tones, like you said, a lot of the reverbs you just add in post, which I think which makes sense. Like, obviously, yeah, if you record someone in like I actually did this in the summer, I worked on a record in a grain silo, and it had like, and it had like a 15, 20 second long reverb time. And it was just like, at some point I was like, hey, we can't record vocals here. Like,
we're
this
done.
Is like,
we're done. Yeah.
Yeah. We did drums there. It was cool. We got some cool sounds. And then I was like, that's all we're doing here. You know,
but it's not usable any longer.
Yeah. But it makes sense. Like, you can definitely paint yourself in a corner when you start to commit to too much stuff, like during the tracking process.
Yeah, I guess I should take that back. I do commit and record through amps with effects all the time.
Okay.
Reverbs and delays and choruses and just certainly distortions are tracked through the amp. I don't rarely add those. I sometimes add more of them, but I don't add them specifically in post. I just mostly meant with, like, I'd only add effects on vocals. And even drums, as far as like, if I do want a reverb or if I want a weird slapback delay, or even if they're playing with a slapback delay, there is definitely on a send. It's not being tracked because you never know if it's going to be cool later on, or if you want to actually mess around with it, some other different process. If it, maybe you want to use an actual space echo, like a real actual tape delay, or if you want to mess around with whatever that plugin is. I don't like to commit to those sounds too soon. Although if they are playing to slapback, I want them to hear it for sure, just so they're performing to it. But definitely vocals are just, they're just added on later.
Yeah. Well, that's actually another question I had was like, how often are they performing to the effect, you know?
Pretty much always. I think if my approach is anything like it used to be as far as back in the tape days, I believe in committing to an idea. I believe to performing to an idea. I believe to say, we are just going to say, this is what we believe is cool, and we're going to go forward with it. I think too many options slows you down. I think it diminishes performances and performance creativity. If you're not ever really like, oh, this doesn't matter because I'm not sure it's going to actually be this way. If we try as much as we can to say, yes, you are playing to this weird flangey chorus, or yes, you are playing to this delay, whether it's, you know, flatback or an eighth note or whatever it is, those change the way you perform. And I really want people to commit to that performance. And I guess you just have to trust your gut on that those sounds are cool. But I guess it also, I most of the time, not always, but because I've been able to do the time, longer time in the studios, you do have a chance to redo it. And if it's just some, you know, a week later, you're like, I think we made a mistake here.
Yeah, you can
recut it. But I do like to go, I like to build off of an idea that I want all of the overdubs and all the performances vocally and everything, guitar, piano, whatever is in the song to be performed off of the same core idea, because it ultimately affects the whole process.
Yeah. Well, kind of goes back to like what you were talking about earlier with like drums and having everyone else play along with it so that, you know, they're feeling the moment, right? So that definitely makes sense as far as using effects as well. That's very cool. Mm-hmm. Like when it comes to things like reverb and delay, you know, obviously those can make things sound bigger and give you that atmosphere and all that, but there's also, it can also be problematic sometimes to add too much of that kind of stuff because it can make your mixes sound really muddy. So, yeah. so as far as like, making the effect of reverb or delay really present in a mix, but without sounding too muddy, how do you typically go about approaching that?
Cutting low end. Let's cut the low end. You don't need it to sound like this extremely. Again, if you listen to a vocal, say on Fleet Foxes or Band Horses, with just the vocal and the reverb, it's not this extremely dense. It sounds dense in the track, but it's not on its own as dense as it seems because I'm shifting the low end so it's not mudding up the kicks and the toms and the lows of the tones of the guitars or bass or whatever. They're really shifted out so that it allows you to push it harder into the mix without changing your two mix level output, without washing that around, not affecting your stereo EQ and compression as much. It's not fluctuating as much because it's less low end kind of rumbling around below you that you just usually don't need. So that's probably the biggest thing I do is shelving out. And that depends on the song and the key of the song and speed of the song, but shelving down out the low end.
Yeah. Obviously, like you said, like it's going to depend on the song and the key and all that kind of stuff. But like, how far are you going as far as shelving?
Like how deep am I going or how many decibels out?
What frequencies would you be like rolling off?
I would
off,
say I'm probably like 200.
Okay. So yeah, you're thinning it out quite a bit then.
Oh yeah, like and almost gone, like really washing that out, just shelving out. I use it on, you know, I use EMT UA EMT plugin all the time. You know, on it, I'll send to it. You know, its input EQ. I'll cut that out. I use the EQ on that as well. Just like that's just whatever it is, 200 down, gone, and then I'll probably do it on the return wherever I'm returning it, either on a you know, mixer of some kind, or even on an analog board, I'll shove that out to just get rid of it because it's just causing energy that takes, you know, in your two mix, it takes up a lot of space. And you're like, why are my vocals like, or why is everything, I have to keep turning things down? And it's probably because you're just supplying too much unnecessarily inaudible energy to the two mix.
Makes sense. Yeah. And then you're definitely keeping all that room there for the low end of the guitar or the bass, kick, and drums.
other stuff. Yeah, you can EQ more into things. You can EQ more kick low and EQ in more bass on the bass guitar or drum or guitars or whatever it happens to be. And that, of course, is just that's the balance of mixing, messing around with where those things hit each other. But keeping effects out of the realm of other things is probably the biggest thing I do.
For sure. Do you find yourself often shelving like the top end as well?
Sometimes. If it's a real plate, yes, because it's going to be noisy. So I'm getting the hiss out of it. But if plugins, I mean, I was a late adapter to anything digital, and not because I was a purist in analog or a purist of tape. I don't care. The original digital sounded so bad to me that I just didn't want to be a part of it. Now, UA plugins and a bunch of different plugins sound amazing. The EMT play plugin sounds great. And I dare people to hear, there's Fleet Foxes record where there's both. And I dare anybody to tell me which one's which. I'm no purist, but I like to use them and make sure that when I am using them, that they're clean and as usable as possible, whatever that clean is, low end removal or high end for cleanliness or whatever it needs to be.
For sure. As far as like reverb types, like obviously, there's lots of options out there like plate, spring, hall, all that kind of stuff. How do you typically approach choosing which one you're going to use when it comes to that kind of thing?
I feel like I go through waves of it. I used to use the Lexicon 480L. Large room all the time. That was my go-to. I love that forever and ever and ever. Then it became a EMT plate. That's my jam. Love that. Love it. That's just my new thing. 40L, that's cool. It's all about plate. And then, now it's like things like, Capital Chambers and stuff like that, Capital Studios Chambers. Like, this is cooler. So it just kind of goes to my flavor at the moment, but they all have their validity. Or springs can certainly be really cool, especially on guitars, because there is that, that real Fender spring reverb attachment to it. It's how everything attaches to it and what feels like it connects, like it actually glues to the sound the most at that time. And that just kind of goes, I feel like I find myself having little crushes on sounds and using them a lot. And then going back to them, I go, how come I don't use a 480L anymore? Oh, it's been 10 years since I've done that. Oh, I'm back in love with that thing or whatever. So,
kind of just makes sense. Yeah. You find your thing that you're most comfortable with in the moment, or that just you find inspiring.
Yeah. It seems exciting or whatever, or just really is working great for that one particular song or that one particular artist. And you're like, that's my new thing. I'm going to continue doing that. That's what I use.
Do you find yourself like using multiple different like reverb styles in a mix? Yeah.
Again, it just depends on the song. Like there's a Father John Misty song, Hollywood Forever Cemetery. The guitar, I just mixed that song. I didn't record that. And the guitar itself was an acoustic guitar, or I think it was, or maybe a hollow body guitar, but the microphone, it was mic'd acoustically, whether it was electric or acoustic, I don't quite remember. But the distortion was coming from a very fuzzed out preamp. And that's fine, but it sounded honestly like a mosquito and it was bone dry. And I was mixing it with Josh Tillman and I said, man, I don't quite understand what to do with this. He's like, he understood that it didn't really fit the grandioseness of that song. So I just did a bunch of different tricks with reverb, and it's a plate on top of a spring with like a gate on top of that. And that's the guitar sound. That's this crazy wild sounding. It sounds like an electric guitar through some wild amp, but it's not at all. And that took me a while to get to that sound, but that's a big example of really using lots of different reverbs to create something that was not recorded that way at all.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, it's a tone shaper as much as it is like an ambience thing. You can use it to like EQ a sound. You can use it to roll off some of that initial attack, all that kind of stuff.
So, you can soften things a lot. Soften attacks. Definitely. You can kind of mellow the approach of the performance in a cool way. It's cool. The cool thing to do with reverb too is compress it. It's a fun, weird thing to do to hold its weird sustain and kind of, you shorten almost, but present the tail of the reverb more in your face, because it kind of crushes up the tail together, and that can make it a bombastic sound out of a reverb. So yeah, do that as well.
Yeah, it's true. Like I think a lot of people just think of effects, or at least a lot of like people who are getting started with this, like think of effects as just like, that's the one thing and that's it. Like you don't manipulate it afterwards, but there's so many other cool things you can do once you start playing around with the EQs or, you know, any sort of saturation and that kind of stuff. You can really get crazy with it and get some cool tones, right?
Right. Distorting the reverb or distorting the send into the reverb. That's kind of a cool thing to do. So you can have this weird, maybe clean vocal here, but behind you have this kind of weirder, ethereal, mildly distorted reverb-y sound. That's the three-dimensionality and the stereo-ness is what can create a lot of depth. And that's what I really strive to do in records I make, is have, even though this, you know, 99% of the records are not Atmos, they're stereo mixes. You know, I want them to feel like you can see the performances in front of you, like the drums and the spectralness of it isn't just left or right, but it feels front and back.
Yeah. So do you rely on like a lot of automation then to also help you with that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of moves that happen either through the board or in Pro Tools. Cause I still mix on the analog board as much as I can, in conjunction with Pro Tools, certainly, because there's a million things you take too long on an analog board, but I do like that summing aspect of an actual analog board, whether it's coming from a digital source, but that does help create three-dimensionality to my mixes.
For sure. Yeah. I think I kind of see things the way you kind of described there, where like I can picture things in a mix and you hear that
right.
Front and back and left and right. And there's like, you know, I like when things move around throughout a song too.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so I was curious to know, like, as far as creating that three dimensionality, obviously like you just talked about, like there's reverbs and some automation and that kind of thing. Are there any other techniques that you can think of that help to create that space or that contrast or whatever?
Well, besides like things like room mics and things of that nature, I think literally, and maybe volume pushes, but doubling things like, or tripling things, like the third guitar happens only in the chorus and it doesn't even necessarily have to jump in volume. Sometimes you could jump in, you can add a way beefier sound or a much brighter sound and it just pops open and it's not EQing something or adding another effect. It's literally adding another track. And that depends on the song, of course, but a lot of times I do that. Just here comes another, or something doubling, like a keyboard doubling the guitar happens, or a piano doubling the guitar, or vice versa. You're just adding more energy in a different way that creates a feeling of a grand feeling to it. Makes it feel like it's moving you into you're jumping into it, or it's coming at you more, and that feels three-dimensional or whatever the scenario may be. So I do that stuff all the time.
Very cool. I love that. Phil, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but one last question I'd love to ask you is, like, at the end of the day, when it comes to all of these different techniques and everything we've just talked about here, like, in your opinion, what ultimately makes a great mix?
I think what ultimately makes a great mix is when whoever is listening to it feels what you are trying to get them to feel. If they listen to it and it makes them excited and you want them to feel excited, you succeeded. If you feel like you want them to feel melancholy, whatever that may be, and they feel that, then that you've succeeded, because music is about feeling it. And most people are not record producers; they're not engineers like us. They're not even in bands. They're just people who like music, and that's who you're making records for, not just yourself, not just the artist. So I guess I often say things, and this is a partial joke, but I often say things in the studio, I want my mom to like this. And and that is a somewhat ridiculous thing to say, but it's true. I want someone who has no idea what music is, or knows, they know what music is, but they just know what they like. And I want them to just to feel what I'm presenting to them. And that's a big part of record making, a big part of proper mixing, is that you've achieved the goal. That's technically perfect. It just has to achieve the goal.
Yeah. The majority of people listening are not technically, like, they don't understand this stuff. So like, they like it or they don't. It's like a binary kind of system for them. Yeah. Right. So it's like, as long as you can get them to like it and feel the energy or the emotion of it, then you've succeeded.
Yeah, we are the 1%, as it were. You know, we are the people who understand this and do this and know the nuts and bolts of it. But you know, 99% of the people, even a lot of musicians don't. They just know what they think is cool and how they feel. So making sure that that's, you know, coming across is most important.
Yeah, I think we're kind of like the masters of like the subliminal messaging in our right, like with right. our process. That's what,
yes.
Yeah, we're kind of trying to do that, right? Like create that feel and introduce things and take things away. And it's like most people don't notice it, but if they experience it, you know.
Oh yeah, they feel it. I've had people, girlfriends, you know, friends over the years, you know, family members say, why don't I like this? And sometimes it's like, well, it sort of just doesn't make sense. It's confusing to listen to. And they don't know why it's confusing to listen to, but I mean, think you're jumbling too many things here. You're trying to present too much information at once, and no one's going to understand this in this mix. So if you just maybe took away a couple of those things and simplified it, or at least made those things that seem more important a little louder, people go, pay attention to this. This is my little milepost I'm supposed to like understand. And you, a lot of part of mixing is just like literally pay attention to this. This is what you should be focusing on as the listener. Yeah. And that creates the emotion for them to gravitate towards it.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, Phil, again, this has been amazing. Like it's been great learning more about your process, your approach to how you think about various elements of the process. I just find that very fascinating. So I want to thank you for being on here. If people want to learn more about you, maybe even potentially work with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Either through my website, which is just philack.com, or through my manager's website, which is gpsmanagement.com.
Awesome. I'll definitely have those in the show notes for sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Right on, Phil. This has been great. I loved it. Thank you so much. Yeah,
thanks a lot, man.
So that was my interview with Phil Eck, and I really enjoyed listening to him describe his process about capturing the feel of an artist and what kind of things he does in the studio to inspire the artist. You know, everything from how he'll have the scratch tracks just be made from the band jamming, and how he doesn't even keep half of the stuff there. It's just more so the drummer can, you know, react to the performances of the other musicians. I think that's awesome. And I think that it's a really cool way to still track things individually, but also retain the feel of a live off the floor recording. So yeah, I love learning about that, and also just some of the little things that he likes to do with effects and how he decides on when he's going to record with an effect or when he's not. And even when he's not recording with the effect, you know, establishing what the artist is listening to so that they're performing into the effect. I think that's a really cool thing too. And I think that the approach that Phil talks about in this interview is a really refreshing one, because it kind of takes the best of both worlds, right? You get the people who want to record everything live off the floor, and then there's the other people who want to record every instrument on its own so that you can really focus on the performances as you're tracking them and you know, make sure that you're getting every single tone right and all that kind of stuff. There's definitely pros and cons to both methods, but I think that Phil's approach here kind of merges the best of those ideas and get the benefits of both approaches. So yeah, definitely a really cool approach that you should definitely take some ideas from this and implement them into your own process too, and you might find that it really helps you with your recordings. Now, speaking of which, if you are a musician recording yourself from home and you're struggling to get your recordings to sound good, or you just can't seem to get your mixes to sound as good as you expect them to, like if you find that when you compare your songs against your favorite records, your songs just fall flat and they don't quite have the same amount of polish or size or whatever it is that your tracks are missing, I would love to help you out with that. Now, inside of my coaching program, Amplitude, I work one-on-one with all of my students to help you figure out what's missing from your tracks and how to get the results you're after. Sometimes it's focusing on the recording stage, sometimes it's focusing on editing or mixing, but regardless of whatever it is, you get one-on-one help where we listen to your tracks and break it apart and help you identify what you need. And we coach you through the entire process, giving you access to a huge library of step-by-step tutorials, walking you through exactly what you need to do at every stage of the recording, editing, and mixing process. Plus, once you've put it all together and you've mixed your track, we then work with you on the mix to help you get the results you want. You know, we cover everything from EQ and compression and whatever else your songs need to get it to that level that you want. So if that sounds like something that you would find beneficial and you'd like to learn more, make sure to visit masteryourmix.com/amplitude. And on that page, you'll get all the details of the program. And you can also apply to get a free demo of that program as well. I'd love to hop on a call with you to learn more about your process, your goals, and to see where we can help you. And if it seems like we can truly help, then I'd love to show you around the program, what it includes, and how you can be part of it as well. We only work with people inside of this program who we truly believe we can help. And if for some reason it seems like we can't help you, we'll definitely let you know. So once again, make sure to visit masteryourmix.com/amplitude, and you can get all the details there. So with that said, we've reached the end of this episode. Thank you so much for sticking around, and I can't wait to chat with you in the next one. We'll talk soon. Bye. Thanks for listening to the Master Your Mix podcast. To have your questions answered, submit your questions to questions@masteryourmix.com. Please go to iTunes and subscribe and leave a review. And for more information on how you can improve your mixes, visit masteryourmix.com.